workers to join unions. I am hopeful that the next president will make signing this Good Jobs executive order one of the first orders of business in 2017. By the stroke of a pen, we can turn the federal government into a model employer instead of a low-wage employer. This executive order would also give us added momentum to increase the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour for all Americans. As part of the decline of our middle class, most of the new jobs being created in this country today are low-wage jobs. The U.S. Department of Labor reported on December 8, 2015, that if we do not reverse course, 7 of the top 10 occupations that will experience the most job growth over the next decade are low-wage jobs. Jobs that don't require a college degree. These occupations include personal and home health care aides, waiters, waitresses, cooks, dishwashers, and others in the restaurant industry, retail salespeople, customer service representatives, and construction workers. But it's not only the new jobs that are being created, it's the lowering of wages for existing jobs. Over the last 15 years, some 60,000 factories have been shut down in the United States, and millions of good-paying jobs have been lost. That's tragic, because many of these jobs were the gold standard for blue-collar workers. But what's equally painful is that many of the manufacturing jobs that remain today are no longer paying decent wages. According to a 2015 study by the National Employment Law Project, almost half of frontline automotive manufacturing jobs in America now pay less than $15 an hour. While we need to do everything we can to make sure that a majority of the jobs of the future are high-quality jobs, we have also got to make sure that no job in America pays a starvation wage. Not only would raising the minimum wage to a living wage lift millions of Americans out of poverty and substantially reduce the federal deficit, it would also lead to more social cohesion and a reduction in crime. One does not have to be a sociologist to understand the connection between poverty, despair, and crime. According to a recent report by the Council of Economic Advisers, higher wages for low-skilled workers reduce both property and violent crime as well as crime among adolescents. The impact of wages on crime is substantial. A 10% increase in wages for non-college educated men results in approximately a 10 to 20% reduction in crime rates. In other words, if we're serious about reducing crime, we need to make sure that every worker in America has the opportunity to earn a living wage and has enough money to support a family. People should feel good about the work they do, not ripped off. There's also a direct correlation between healthy babies and higher wages. Researchers at the University of Iowa, the University of Illinois, and Bentley University have found that every dollar increase in the minimum wage leads to a 2% reduction in the risk of a mother having a baby with a low birth weight. Poverty causes stress. Stress causes illness. Decent wages will keep our people healthier. In terms of wage policy in America, the nation with more income and wealth inequality than any other major country, the bottom line is not complicated. No full-time worker should live in poverty. We must raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Equal pay for equal work. A living wage should not only be fair, it should be equitable. That is why every man must stand with every woman in the fight for pay equality. Women are sick and tired of making 79 cents for every dollar a man earns. They want the whole damn dollar, and they are right in wanting it. In 1963, President John F. Kennedy signed into law the Equal Pay Act, requiring employers to provide equal pay for equal work, regardless of gender. During the signing ceremony of this landmark legislation, President Kennedy said that this bill affirms our determination that when women enter the labor force, they will find equality in their pay envelopes. A year later, the 1964 Civil Rights Act went a step further by prohibiting all wage discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, gender, or national origin. But today, despite major advances in civil and political rights over the past 50 years, we still have not come close to achieving pay equality for women in America. 50 years ago, women made up about one-third of our nation's workforce and were paid just 59 cents for every dollar a man earned. Today, women make up nearly half of the U.S. workforce, yet the average woman working full-time in this country still earns just 79 cents for every dollar a man makes. And the gender pay gap is even worse for women of color. African American women earn just 64 cents for every dollar a white man earns, while the figure for Hispanic women is just 54 cents, and the figure for Native American women, only 59 cents. The reality is that our country still has a very long way to go to truly make gender equality a reality. The gender wage gap is a real and persistent problem that continues to shortchange women and families. Our economy works best when it works for all of us, men and women. As a nation, this is an issue that must be addressed together. Today, a record-breaking 40% of all households with children have a mother who is either the sole or primary breadwinner, up from just 11% in 1960. This means pay equality is not just a women's issue. When women do not receive equal pay for equal work, families across America have less money to spend on childcare, groceries, food, and housing. Single moms are some of the most courageous people I have ever met. At the same time, as they have the responsibility of taking care of their kids, they have to work full-time and make a living. This is tough. This is stressful. They should not be paid less than they deserve. For millions of families across America, the pay gap between men and women can be the difference between being able to pay the hospital bill or going without needed medical care. It can be the difference between being able to pay the heating bill or going cold in the winter. And it can be the difference between paying the mortgage or losing a home to foreclosure. We've been told that one of the major reasons for the gender pay gap is that men are much more likely to graduate from college than women and thus get better paying jobs. While that was true in the 1960s and 1970s, it is no longer the case and hasn't been for a while. Since the 1990s, women have received more undergraduate and graduate degrees than men, but the gender pay gap has remained roughly the same for the past 15 years. What this means is that women with a college degree end up making hundreds of thousands of dollars less than men during the course of their careers. There's nothing fair about that. I don't want my granddaughters to grow up with the belief that the work they do will be valued less than that of men. That can no longer be considered normal in the United States of America. The reality is that the median earnings of women are lower than those of men in virtually every industry in America. That is true for work primarily done by women, such as teaching, nursing, and administrative jobs. It is also true for jobs done predominantly by men, such as truck driving, management, and software development. And with some occupations, the gender pay gap is downright obscene. For example, women financial sales agents make 48% less than men. Women who are personal financial advisors make 41% less than their male colleagues. Even women who enter the legal profession still make just 60 cents for every dollar a man earns doing the same work. In the 21st century, we have also got to stop penalizing women in the workplace for having children. New mothers should receive the same type of respect and remuneration on the job that men receive when they are about to become fathers. According to one recent study from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, when men have children, their earnings go up by 6%. What happens to women? For every child they have, their income goes down by 4%. That is absurd. How do we create a nation in which all people, regardless of gender, get equal pay for equal work? For starters, we need to pass the Paycheck Fairness Act into law. It's hard to know if you're being paid fairly if you don't know what your coworkers are earning. This legislation would, among other things, prohibit employers from retaliating against employees for discussing wages and salaries with their coworkers. According to a 2014 survey by the Institute for Women Policy Research, 60% of women in the private sector, including 2 out of 3 single mothers, reports that they are either discouraged or prohibited from talking about wages and salaries with their coworkers. When women are afraid of losing their jobs or being demoted simply for asking their male counterparts how much they earn, employers have a much easier time discriminating against them in the workplace. But while transparency regarding wages is a good first step, it is not enough. Employers must be required to prove that any differences in wages have nothing to do with gender, race, religion, sexual orientation, or national origin. In 2007, millions of Americans were shocked to learn that the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 against Lilly Ledbetter in her case against Goodyear, even though she had proof that she'd been paid substantially less than her male colleagues for decades. The conservative Supreme Court ruled against Ms. Ledbetter because she didn't file her lawsuit within 180 days of receiving her discriminatory paycheck. The Supreme Court apparently didn't care that she didn't even know she was being discriminated against until many years after the fact. And while President Obama signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act in 2009 to correct this injustice in the future, it is nowhere near sufficient. We need laws that make it unprofitable for companies to engage in pay discrimination. Far too often, when companies get caught illegally paying women less than men, the fines they receive are little more than a slap on the wrist. For example, in 2015, Home Depot was required to pay a mere $83,400 by the U.S. Department of Labor to 46 female job applicants at one Home Depot location who were steered into low-wage cashier jobs while male applicants received higher-paying jobs as sales associates. In 2013, Bank of America agreed to pay $39 million to settle a nationwide gender discrimination case filed by female stockbrokers against the bank and its Merrill Lynch brokerage arm, who were paid substantially less than their male colleagues. This may seem like a lot of money, but for Bank of America, the second largest financial institution in the country, it was little more than chicken feed. In fact, that very same year, Bank of America made $11.4 billion in profits. Merrill Lynch has a long history of litigation over its treatment of women and minority employees. Novartis, a global healthcare company based in Switzerland, settled a sexual discrimination case in January of 2016 for $8.2 million. It had been filed by more than a dozen female employees who claimed they were denied equal pay and job promotions. Again, that may seem like a lot, but I wonder if this company, with a market cap of $280 billion and annual profits north of $7 billion, will even notice. On and on it goes. Major corporation after major corporation gets caught for violating pay equality laws. The fines they pay are minimal. Companies that break the law regarding pay equity should not be treated with impunity. As a nation, we've got to end all forms of discrimination. It is time to guarantee pay equity in America. Making it easier for workers to join unions. To build the middle class, we must make it easier, not harder, for workers to join unions. The benefits of joining a union are clear. Union workers earn 27% more, on average, than non-union workers. Over 76% of union workers have guaranteed defined benefit pension plans, while only 16% of non-union workers do. More than 82% of workers in unions have paid sick leave, compared with just 62% of non-union workers. 40 years ago, more than a quarter of all workers belonged to a union. Today, that number has gone down to just 11%. And in the private sector, it is now less than 7%. Republican governors across the country have pushed anti-union right-to-work legislation that has drastically cut labor membership in this country. Historically, unions have enabled workers to earn good wages and work in decent conditions because of collective bargaining. Today, millions of workers are in a take-it-or-leave-it situation with no power to influence their wages or benefits. It's not a coincidence that the decline of the American middle class virtually mirrors the rapid decline in union membership. As workers lose their seats at the negotiating table, the share of national income going to middle-class workers has gone down, while the percentage of income going to the very wealthy has gone up. There's no question that one of the most significant reasons for the 40-year decline in the middle class is the rights of workers to join together and bargain for better wages. Benefits and working conditions have been severely undermined. For decades now, there's been a terrible assault on the right to organize, and one of the chief tools employers use to undermine the formation of unions is intimidation. Today, if an employee is engaged in a union organizing campaign, that employee has a 1 in 5 chance of getting fired. Half of all employers threaten to close or relocate their businesses if workers elect to form a union. And when workers become interested in forming a union, they will almost always be forced to attend closed-door meetings to hear anti-union propaganda. And their supervisors will almost always be forced to attend training sessions on how to attack unions. As Human Rights Watch has said, freedom of association is a right under severe, often buckling pressure when workers in the United States try to exercise it. Moreover, even when workers, faced with all of these enormous obstacles, are able to form a union, more than half of the victories do not result in a first contract within a year after the election has taken place. Even as corporate executives routinely negotiate obscenely high compensation packages for themselves, replete with bonuses, options, and many perks, they deny their own employees the ability to bargain for better wages and benefits. The hypocrisy is stunning. It is time to turn this around. We must pass legislation that makes it clear that when a majority of workers in a bargaining unit sign valid authorization cards to join a union, they will have a union. Period. Further, companies must not be allowed to deny or delay a first contract with workers who have voted to join a union. And when companies refuse to negotiate in good faith, there should be arbitration that leads to the completion of the first contract within 6 months. We need to send a very loud and a very clear message to corporate America. We will no longer tolerate CEOs who will fire workers for exercising their constitutional right to form a union. We will no longer tolerate CEOs who threaten to move plants to China if their workers vote in favor of a union. We will no longer tolerate CEOs and managers who intimidate or threaten pro-union workers. If we are serious about reducing income and wealth equality and rebuilding the middle class, we've got to substantially increase the number of union jobs in this country. Real family values. I have 4 great kids and 7 beautiful grandchildren. My wife and I have been married for 27 years. We believe in family values and in strengthening families. But our family values are just a little bit different from Republican ones. The right has claimed the mantle of family values for far too long. When my Republican colleagues use this term, they're usually talking about things like opposing contraception, denying a woman's right to choose, opposing gay rights, and supporting abstinence-only education. Let me give a somewhat different perspective on family values, on real family values. When a mother cannot spend time with her newborn child during the first weeks and months of that baby's life, and is forced back to work because her employer doesn't offer paid family leave and she can't afford not to work, that is not a family value. That is an attack on everything that a family is supposed to stand for. When a husband cannot get time off from work to care for his cancer-stricken wife or gravely ill child, that is not a family value. That is an attack on everything that a family is supposed to stand for. When a mother is forced to send her sick child to school because her employer doesn't provide sick time and she cannot afford to stay home, that is not a family value. That is an attack on everything that a family is supposed to stand for. When a husband, wife, and kids during the course of an entire year are unable to spend any time together on a vacation, that is not a family value. That is an attack on everything that family is supposed to stand for. That's wrong. It's a travesty, and it should be an embarrassment to anyone who claims to speak for family values in this country. So the next time you hear a politician talking about family values, you should ask whether he or she supports measures that really help American families, paid family and medical leave, paid sick days, and paid vacation. These initiatives will help families spend more time together in greater happiness and security. Those are values every family can believe in. Paid family and medical leave. When it comes to supporting real family values, we are the only advanced economy that doesn't guarantee its workers some form of paid family leave, paid sick leave, or paid vacation leave. Or to put that another way, workers and families in every other major industrialized country get a better deal than we do in the United States. Here are just a few examples. In Canada, parents are guaranteed 35 weeks of parental leave at 55% of their salary. In France, parents are guaranteed at least 6 months of paid maternity leave at more than $625 a month. In Germany, parents are guaranteed 1 year of paid leave at 67% of their salary. In Japan, parents are guaranteed 6 months of paid leave, also at 67% of their salary. In Norway, working parents who have a baby are entitled to 49 weeks of paid leave at 100% of their wages. But here in the U.S., workers are not guaranteed any paid leave. Zero. As a result, more than 23% of working mothers in America have to go back to work just 2 weeks after giving birth, just 2 weeks to bond with and spend time with their newborn babies, and more than 45% of women without college degrees go back to work less than 6 weeks after giving birth. Out of 188 countries studied by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, and the International Labor Organization, the U.S. and Papua New Guinea are the only two countries in the world that don't provide paid maternity leave. When it comes to having policies that value the contributions of women and that honor and celebrate families, last place is no place for America. It's time to join the rest of the world by showing the people of this country that we are not just a nation that talks about family values, but one that is prepared to live up to those ideals by making sure workers in this country have access to paid family leave, paid sick leave, and paid vacations, just like workers in virtually every other country on earth. Simply stated, it is an outrage that millions of women in this country give birth and then are forced back to work because they don't have the income to stay home with their newborn babies. Virtually every psychologist who has studied this issue agrees that the first weeks and months of life are enormously important to a newborn's emotional and intellectual development, and it's understood that mothers and fathers should spend this time bonding with the new person they have brought into the world. In some cases, this is even a matter of life or death. The U.S. has the highest infant mortality rate in the industrialized world, and a recent study by researchers at UCLA and McGill University found that enacting paid family leave policies can substantially reduce infant mortality. According to this study, every additional month of paid family leave can reduce the infant mortality rate by 13%. The Family and Medical Leave Act that Congress passed in 1993 is totally inadequate for our 21st century workforce. The FMLA requires some employers to provide workers up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave for personal or family illness, military leave, pregnancy, adoption, or the foster care placement of a child. However, the FMLA only covers employees in companies with 50 or more employees, and it only requires unpaid rather than paid leave. Almost 40% of all American workers are not even covered by the FMLA because they work for companies with fewer than 50 employees. And nearly 8 out of 10 workers in this country who are covered by the FMLA and are theoretically eligible to take time off under this law cannot afford to do so. In my view, every worker in America should be guaranteed at least 12 weeks of paid family and medical leave. And that is why Congress needs to pass the Family Act, introduced by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand in the Senate and Representative Rosa DeLauro in the House. This legislation would guarantee employees 12 weeks of paid family and medical leave to take care of a baby, to help a family member who is diagnosed with cancer or has some other serious medical condition, or to take care of themselves if they become seriously ill. Under this bill, workers would be eligible to receive paid family and medical leave benefits equal to 66% of their typical monthly wages, capped at a maximum amount of $1,000 per week for high-income workers. And just like Social Security, retirement, and disability, paid family and medical leave would be an insurance program that workers pay into with every paycheck at a price of about $1.61 a week for the typical full-time employee. In my view, that is a pretty good investment in our nation's families and the future economic well-being of our country. Now, there are some who have criticized this legislation because it would increase taxes on middle-class and working families. These critics claim that working families can't afford to pay for this program. They have it backward. The reality is that it's too expensive right now for millions of individual workers to take time off when they have a new baby or need to take care of a loved one with a serious medical condition. Today, it would cost the average worker more than $9,300 in lost wages to take 12 weeks of unpaid leave. Most workers simply do not have that kind of money. In fact, according to a December 2015 survey, 63% of Americans do not even have $500 in their bank accounts to pay for an unexpected medical emergency or needed car repair. Just think about it for a moment. How many senior citizens would be living in poverty today if President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had opposed a small payroll tax in the 1930s to fund Social Security? How many seniors would not have health insurance today if President Lyndon Baines Johnson had opposed a payroll tax increase to fund Medicare in the 1960s? Fortunately, we don't have to answer these questions today. What FDR correctly understood in terms of Social Security and what LBJ understood in terms of Medicare is the importance of all workers having the legally earned right to a secure retirement and affordable health care insurance that could not be easily taken away from them by a future Congress. The truth is that the economic benefits of paid family and medical leave more than outweigh the very modest costs of this program. Women who have paid family leave are more likely to stay in the workforce and off federal programs like Medicaid, food stamps, and public housing. Families that have paid leave are much less likely to declare bankruptcy, and children have a greater chance of leading healthy and more productive lives if their parents have paid family leave. The good news is that California, New Jersey, Rhode Island, Washington, and New York have all passed laws guaranteeing paid family and medical leave to workers. California and New Jersey guarantee workers 6 weeks of paid family and medical leave. And in Rhode Island, workers are eligible for 4 weeks of paid leave. Beginning in 2018, New York will become the first state in the nation to offer workers 12 weeks of paid family and medical leave. And all of these programs are funded by a payroll tax similar to the Gillibrand-DeLauro Family Act. In the year 2016, it is time for all Americans to stand together and say loudly and clearly, not only that we are going to make sure every worker receives at least 12 weeks of paid family and medical leave, but that it is paid for in a way that is fair and progressive. Paid sick leave for all. We've also got to make sure that workers in this country have paid sick time. In my view, it is insane that low-wage workers for companies like McDonald's must work when they are sick just because they cannot afford to stay home. Not only is this bad for the workers who are sick, it's also a public health issue. Who wants to eat food cooked by someone who has the flu or some other contagious illness? The Health Families Act, introduced by Senator Patty Murray, would begin to fix this. This bill would guarantee 7 days of paid sick leave per year for American workers. It would benefit 43 million Americans who don't have access to paid sick leave today. And it would also establish a minimum standard for employers who already do offer sick leave. Congress needs to pass this legislation, and the president must sign it into law as soon as possible. American workers need a vacation. Moreover, when we're talking about a disappearing middle class, we're talking about millions of Americans working longer hours for lower wages. We're talking about millions of Americans who are overworked, underpaid, and under enormous stress. Some are working two or three jobs just trying to care for their families. What we have are millions of people working incredibly long hours, some with two or three jobs, just trying to care for themselves and their families. Today, largely because of the collapse of our middle class and declining wages, Americans are working longer hours than the people of any other major developed country in the G7, which includes Japan, Germany, Canada, the United Kingdom, France, and Italy. According to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, in 2015, Americans worked 419 more hours than the Germans, more than the French, 125 more than the Australians, more than the British, 84 more than Canadians, and 71 hours more than the Japanese. That is why I have introduced legislation to require employers to provide at least 10 days of paid vacation to workers in this country every year. This is not a radical idea. It is already being done in almost every country in the world, and it is one more way to demonstrate our commitment to family values. Today, the U.S. is one of only 13 countries in the world that does not guarantee paid vacation. That puts the U.S. in company with India, Pakistan, and Sierra Leone. My bill would allow workers to take 2 weeks of paid vacation so that they can rest and recuperate, travel the country, visit loved ones, or simply spend time at home with their families. Studies show that 9 in 10 Americans report that their happiest memories are associated with vacations. And while companies like Costco and Twitter have adopted generous paid vacation policies aimed at boosting productivity and worker loyalty, nearly 1 in 4 American workers gets no paid vacation time, including about half of all low-wage workers. Even worse, 41% of workers didn't take one day of vacation in 2015. Meanwhile, workers in France get an entire month off paid every year. Scandinavian countries guarantee 25 days of paid vacation. Germany mandates 20 days. And Japan and Canada both guaranteed 10 paid vacation days per year. The United States is the wealthiest country in the history of the world. And the reason we are so prosperous is because the men and women of this country work so hard. They deserve a paid vacation. And let's be clear. We're not asking for the most generous vacation policy in the world, nothing like what they get in France, Scandinavia, or Germany, but simply a standard befitting a great nation that takes seriously its commitment to family values. Research shows that vacations reduce stress, strengthen family relationships, increase productivity, and even prevent illness. There's no reason not to pass this bill. It would benefit workers while also helping employers, the economy, and society as a whole. Jobs, jobs, jobs. In a modern society, people have the right to a decent job at decent pay. There are enormous needs in this country that must be addressed. Let's put the unemployed and underemployed to work transforming America. Let's create a full employment economy. A job is more than a job. It's more than just making an income. A job is, in an important sense, how we relate to the world in which we live. Being a productive member of society, a contributor to the well-being of our neighbors and our community, gives our lives meaning, dignity, and satisfaction. In 1944, in his second-to-last State of the Union speech, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt stated, "We have come to a clear realization of the fact that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence." He talked about the need to establish a second Bill of Rights, an economic Bill of Rights for the American people, a set of principles as important as the political freedoms guaranteed by our Constitution. The very first right that Roosevelt listed was the right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation. That profound principle was true in 1944. It is true today. We must create a full employment economy. Today, as mentioned earlier, real unemployment is not 5%. It's almost 10%. If one includes those who have given up looking for work, or were working part-time when they want to work full-time. In many communities around the country, the unemployment rate is even higher than that, and it is tragically high among young people who are not college graduates. Today, it is estimated that about 20 million Americans are unemployed or underemployed, and that less than 63% of the adult population has a job. If we're serious about reversing the decline of the middle class, we need a major federal jobs program that puts millions of Americans to work at decent-paying jobs. A full employment economy will not only improve the standard of living of millions of Americans, it will create a more efficient and productive society. We're not talking about make-work projects that keep people busy to justify a paycheck. We are talking about putting millions of people to work building an economy that addresses the enormous unmet needs we face and creating the kind of country we can and must become. We need jobs to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure, our roads, bridges, water systems, wastewater plants, airports, railroads, levees, and dams. We need workers to help us lead the world in combating climate change, making our homes and buildings more energy efficient, and transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel and into sustainable energy. We will also need a 21st century grid capable of transmitting that energy. We need workers to help us address the crisis in affordable housing, making certain that every family in America lives in safe and affordable housing. This means not only building millions of units of new housing, but rebuilding the older housing stock in communities throughout the country. We need workers to create a modern pre-K and child care system worthy of the youngest Americans and their parents. We need workers to make certain that our children attend modern, well-constructed schools, and we need the best and brightest of our young people to enter the teaching profession so that our kids get a world-class education. We need workers to build, in every community in America, urban and rural, a high-quality broadband system. In the modern world, broadband is a necessity, not a luxury. We need more doctors, nurses, dentists, and other medical personnel in order to provide quality health care to all as a right. There are medically underserved areas in large cities and small towns where millions of Americans, even those with insurance, are unable to access the health care that they need. We need to make it easier for the entrepreneurial spirit to flourish. That means providing help to those businesses that really need it, not to large and profitable corporations that are shipping our jobs abroad. We need to experiment with new economic models. In more and more work sites throughout the country, workers now own and control their own businesses through employee-owned enterprises. This approach often results in increased productivity and greater job satisfaction. It is a concept that should be expanded. Rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. At a time when our roads, bridges, water systems, rails and airports, levees, dams, schools, and housing stock are decaying, the most effective way to rapidly create meaningful jobs is to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. That's why I've introduced legislation that would invest $1 trillion over 5 years to modernize our country's physical infrastructure. This legislation would create and maintain at least 13 million good-paying jobs, while making our country more productive, efficient, and safe. It would be paid for by eliminating tax loopholes that allow multinational corporations to stash their profits in tax havens around the world to avoid about $100 billion a year in federal taxes. The American people understand that our infrastructure is collapsing all around us. Every day, we drive across bridges that are in disrepair and on roads with unforgiving potholes. We get trapped in never-ending traffic jams that tax our nerves and ride in overcrowded railroad and subway trains that often get us to work late. We travel through antiquated airports where planes are often canceled or delayed for preventable reasons. In many parts of the country, people worry that local levees could give way in a storm, flooding towns and cities. These worries are very real, as we saw when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. In hundreds of communities all over our country, officials are now struggling with toxic and polluted drinking water. We've seen what happened in Flint, Michigan, but communities all across the country, from southern Vermont to West Virginia to California, all have serious problems with the quality of their water. I understand that infrastructure is not exactly the most exciting issue out there. Last time I checked, infrastructure activists were not turning out tens of thousands of people to protest the sorry state of our nation's culverts. But let's be clear, the state of our infrastructure is of enormous importance to our country. It greatly impacts the quality of our lives, our economy, and the environment. It makes a real difference in people's lives if they can drive to work on non-congested roads. It matters that people can travel safely and efficiently on trains and subways. The quality of life for millions of Americans will be improved if they are living in safe and affordable homes rather than overpriced and dilapidated apartments. We have the right to know that the water we are drinking is safe and that our children are attending high-quality schools. These are not radical demands. This is what America should be about. This is the kind of America we can create. For most of our history, the United States has proudly led the world in building innovative infrastructure, from a network of canals to the Transcontinental Railroad to airport construction to the interstate highway system. We launched an ambitious rural electrification program, massive flood control projects, and more. These innovations grew our economy. It gave our businesses a competitive advantage, provided our workers a decent standard of living, and were the envy of the world. Sadly, that is no longer the case. The American Society of Civil Engineers gave our infrastructure an overall grade of D+ in its most recent report card. How can it be that the United States, the richest and most powerful nation in the history of the planet, has let its infrastructure slip into such disrepair that it is at a strong risk of failure? The answer, it turns out, is quite simple. For decades, we have significantly underfunded the maintenance and improvement of the physical infrastructure that our country depends on. We've given tax breaks to the wealthy rather than investing in our future. The United States now spends just 2.4% of gross domestic product on infrastructure, less than at any point in the last 20 years. Meanwhile, Europe spends more than twice our gross share of GDP on infrastructure, and China spends close to four times our rate. Today, the United States' overall infrastructure ranks 13th in the world, down from 7th just a decade ago. Almost one-third of our nation's roads are in poor or mediocre condition, while more than 40% of urban highways are considered congested. We spend 6.9 billion hours stuck in traffic each year, wasting 3.8 billion gallons of fuel, costing $160 billion, and causing significant frustration and even rage. And that does not include the environmental costs of the carbon emissions from unnecessarily burning that extra 3.8 billion gallons of fuel. Every driver spends, on average, an extra $325 each year in vehicle repairs due to our bad roads. And while there's no national database of deaths and injuries caused by deficient transportation infrastructure, the U.S. Department of Transportation estimates that highway deaths from obsolete and poor roads could be as high as 14,000 per year. Nearly a quarter of our nation's bridges are rated as functionally obsolete, and an astounding one of every nine is considered structurally deficient. One such bridge was the I-35 bridge in Minneapolis on August 1st, 2007, on the very same day that a bipartisan group of U.S. senators held a largely ignored press conference in Washington about the deteriorating condition of our nation's infrastructure. The westbound I-35 bridge collapsed, killing 13 people and injuring 145. Light rail and bus transit systems across the country, because of a lack of funding, are postponing billions of dollars in needed repairs and upgrades, even as more people take buses, trains, and subways to get to work. Obviously, when mass transit options aren't good, more people choose to ride in cars, which creates more wear and tear on our roads and more congestion. It's a lose-lose situation. Meanwhile, 45% of American households lack any meaningful access to transit at all, which continues to be a significant issue in rural areas, such as my state of Vermont. People in rural areas should have options for getting to work other than their cars. Our nation's passenger and freight rail networks are antiquated, in spite of the fact that Amtrak's ridership has never been higher, and our energy-efficient railroads move more freight than ever. While we have partisan debates in Congress about the merits of high-speed rail, countries across Europe and Asia have gone ahead and built networks where trains travel at 200 miles per hour and faster. High-speed rail relieves congestion on highways and at airports, and whisks people around quickly and efficiently in dozens of countries. In contrast, the Acela, Amtrak's fastest train, travels at an average speed of just 65 miles per hour. Anyone who flies regularly knows that many of America's airports are bursting at the seams, and that there are too many non-weather-related delays and cancellations. The cost of airport delays is approaching $25 billion a year, and the FAA estimates it will reach $34 billion a year by 2020 unless we improve airport capacity and efficiency. Our airports need almost $76 billion over the next 5 years to accommodate growth in passenger and cargo activity and to rehabilitate existing facilities. Are we facing this situation? No. And maybe even worse, many of our airports still rely on outdated 1960s radar technology because Congress chronically underfunds deployment of a new satellite-based air traffic control system. According to the American Water Works Association, we need to increase attention to the serious water problems that we have. Much of our drinking water infrastructure, the more than 1 million miles of pipes beneath our streets, is nearing the end of its useful life and approaching the age in which it needs to be replaced. Delaying the investment we need, nearly $1 trillion, can result in degrading water service, increasing water service disruptions, and increasing expenditures from emergency repairs. In February 2016, I visited Flint, Michigan, and saw firsthand a tragic example of human cost of a crumbling water system which left the city's drinking water poisoned with toxic lead. In their reckless zeal to slash spending, public officials jeopardized the health and well-being of the residents they are entrusted with keeping safe. Rather than wait 3 years for a new water pipe that would bring water from Lake Huron to Flint, a revolving door of emergency managers, appointed by Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, decided to save a few dollars by taking water from the highly polluted Flint River. in April of 2014 with the blessing of Michigan environmental officials. Water from the squalid Flint River started to flow into homes and businesses. Residents immediately complained about the foul smell, awful taste, and brown color of the water, and some became ill with E. coli infections and other maladies. But an even bigger, invisible problem was lurking. The polluted river water and the harsh chemicals added to make it drinkable corroded Flint's aging water pipes and leached highly toxic lead into the water supply. When ingested, even small amounts of lead can cause serious health problems, especially for children under the age of 6, who can experience severe behavior problems and learning disabilities. At very high levels, lead poisoning can be fatal. A practicing pediatrician, Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, helped bring the problem to the public's attention, even though state agencies dismissed her concerns for months. She believes all of Flint's 8,657 children under 6 years old are at significant risk of damning, lifelong, and generational consequences, and will likely need substantial resources to manage the long-term effects on their health and educational attainment. Flint is a wake-up call to the fragile nature of our public water supply, but, unfortunately, Flint is not alone. The water in Hannibal, Missouri, has been undrinkable for 3 years, having been found to harm the liver, kidneys, and central nervous system. Water mismanagement in Tyler, Texas, has led to an increased cancer risk. The water in Gardena, California, turned brown and green last year. Toxic algae in Lake Erie, fed by unchecked phosphorus runoff, made the water undrinkable for 500,000 residents of Toledo, Ohio in 2014. Even regarding lead, Flint is not alone. According to the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, about 1,000 systems serving nearly 4 million people reported exceeding the EPA's action level of 15 parts per billion of lead in their drinking water between 2013 and 2015. Not surprisingly, these environmental crises tend to disproportionately affect poor and minority communities, people without a lot of political clout. Let me say it once more. We live in the richest country in the history of the world. It is absurd that increasingly we are unable to drink the water that comes out of the faucets in our homes. If we address this problem, we would reduce health risks and save substantial sums of money. It is projected that in 2017 we will spend more money for bottled water than we do for soda. We would also create a significant number of jobs. Our wastewater treatment plants are not in much better shape. Each year, tens and sometimes hundreds of billions of gallons of untreated sewage is discharged into our nation's waterways when plants fail or pipes burst, often during heavy rains. The cost of cleaning up after these failures runs into the billions of dollars a year and causes long-term environmental damage to our rivers and lakes. More than 4,000 of our dams are rated as deficient, and nearly 9% of all our levees are likely to fail during a major flood. As we have seen, this is a life and death issue. Major recent disasters, and there have been many, pale in comparison to the damage caused in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Katrina was a massive storm when it hit New Orleans in August 2005, causing widespread destruction and loss of life. However, the bulk of the tragedy began when the levees in New Orleans failed after the storm had passed. And we should never forget how it ended, with 1,500 dead, close to $100 billion in damage, and whole neighborhoods wiped out in one of America's most historic cities. When we talk about a deteriorating infrastructure, we're talking about human life at risk, human health at risk, and major economic losses. Bottlenecks at our marine seaports, which handle 95% of all overseas imports and exports, cause delays that prevent goods from getting to their destinations on time. The same is true for our inland waterways, which carry the equivalent of 50 million truck trips of goods each year. American businesses are increasingly being put at a competitive disadvantage in the global economy because they can't easily transport their goods and services to market, and because their employees find it hard to get to work affordably. It is estimated that American businesses lose $27 billion a year in delays and extra shipping costs, which are invariably passed along to consumers. One of the things we take for granted is electricity. In the 1930s, the federal government made it possible for everyone, even those in very rural areas, to have electric power at their homes. But today, America's aging electrical grid consists of an antiquated patchwork system of interconnected power generation, transmission, and distribution facilities, some of which date back to the early 1900s. Our grid suffers from hundreds of major power failures each year, many of which are avoidable. Our grid simply is not up to 21st century challenges, including possible cyber attacks and resiliency after ever more common extreme weather events. The World Economic Forum ranks our electric grid at 24th in the world in terms of reliability, just behind Barbados. Yes, Barbados. We invented and developed the internet in the United States, but today we're falling behind many other countries in access and speed. We are, sad to say, 16th in the world in terms of broadband access, and we are only marginally better in terms of average broadband speed. How can it be that businesses, schools, and families in Bucharest, Romania, have access to much faster and less expensive internet service than does most of the United States? How can it be that in the year 2016, in rural areas all over this country, internet service remains non-existent or extremely slow? What the Rural Electrification Act did in the 1930s for electric service, the Congress must do today for universal and affordable broadband. It should be abundantly clear to any reasonable person that the economic status quo is not working. We have to think big and act boldly. A $1 trillion investment in rebuilding our physical and human infrastructure would go a long way toward transforming our country and moving to a full employment economy. In fact, investing in infrastructure would give the economy a bigger bang for the buck than any other federal investment. The International Monetary Fund, IMF, hardly a bastion of radical economic theory, recently reported that well-designed infrastructure projects, including those paid for with borrowed money, effectively pay for themselves because the projects spur almost $3 in economic output for each dollar spent. If spending $1 trillion over 5 years to improve our infrastructure and create jobs is a lot of money, consider for a moment the cost of not acting. As I have noted, the sad state of our infrastructure is a significant drag on our economy. The total cost likely already exceeds $200 billion in lost productivity per year, which, incidentally, is exactly the amount I propose to spend each year to fix the problem. And that doesn't count the human cost of not acting. I was a mayor for 8 years, and one thing I learned very quickly was that deteriorating infrastructure does not magically get better by ignoring it. It just gets worse and more expensive to fix. It is easier to maintain roads and bridges than to rebuild them. The most cost-effective way to deal with infrastructure is through a strong and consistent maintenance program, and not building strong new systems today will leave our communities weaker later on and our businesses less able to compete on a global scale. There's no reason on earth why the richest country in history can't deliver a sound infrastructure to its people. And no surprise, there's no question that this is what the American people want. A 2013 Gallup poll found that 72% of the American people support increasing government spending on infrastructure projects that put people to work. The good news is that it's not too late to get back on track. Our political revolution demands that we improve the physical infrastructure our economy and our society depends on, and in the process creates the millions of jobs we so desperately need. Creating jobs and clean energy. When we talk about rebuilding America and making our country more efficient, productive, and safe, there's no issue more important in my mind than combating climate change and transforming our energy system away from fossil fuels and into energy efficiency and sustainable energy. When we do that, we not only help lead the world in saving the planet, but we create an extraordinary number of good-paying jobs. The scientific community is virtually unanimous in telling us that to avoid truly catastrophic consequences, we have a short window of time to dramatically cut the greenhouse gases that cause global warming. I've laid out a plan to cut U.S. carbon pollution by at least 40% by 2030 and 80% by 2050 from 1990 levels by establishing a tax on carbon, aggressively implementing energy efficiency efforts, quickly moving away from fossil fuels and deploying historic levels of new renewable energy like wind, solar, and geothermal. This is an absolutely and necessary achievable goal. It is also a huge opportunity in terms of strengthening our economy and creating needed jobs. Let's start with energy efficiency. Homes, office buildings, factories, schools, libraries, and other buildings can all be made significantly more efficient with state-of-the-art insulation, LED lighting, and modern heating and cooling systems. For every dollar invested in efficiency upgrades, families and businesses can enjoy up to $4 in energy savings. And for every $1 billion spent, we can